Hello, I'm Alan Saunders. Welcome to the Comfort Zone. And now we're headed into the garden to enjoy the fruits of our own labours. If the proliferation of magazines, radio and TV programmes devoted to the subject is any indication, gardening is one of the most popular hands-on activities in Australia today. Now, I enjoy sitting under a shady tree, a soft organic carpet under my feet, looking over a green vista, but the idea of creating such a space is another matter. Apart from the fact that I live in an inner city apartment, I'm not alone when I express reservations like, it's hard to know where to start when designing a garden, and then there's all that hard work to maintain it. Well, permaculture may be the answer. According to Jenny Allen, after an initial period of planning and physical work, the garden practically looks after itself. And she's written a book about the development of her own garden in Mullaney in Queensland called Paradise in the Garden. And Jenny Allen joins me now from Perth. Jenny, welcome to the piece of paradise we call the Comfort Zone.
Good morning, Alan.
Good morning. Now, first of all, can you describe for us the underlying principles of permaculture?
Permaculture is a very smart type of garden design, and the reason it is so smart is that it copies nature, and nature's highly efficient and abundant. So it's basically pulled out 10 principles of nature, and as you mentioned before, it means that it's less work and more abundant. So you put a lot of more energy into the design, and in doing this you can meet a lot of your needs. So you have a lot of vegetables, a lot of fruit, herbs, maybe some cabinet timbers, firewood, and by designing well you can also have less pests, a lot better water management. So all in all, eventually you can sit back and enjoy the fruits and let the garden do the work for you.
And can people who don't live on a large piece of land in the country, can they still make a permaculture garden?
Yes, it's designed so it's applicable for people like you, Alan. You can sit on the veranda and perhaps pluck some herbs or have a little worm farm there or maybe some water chestnuts in the tub. And it goes right through to people that live on a large property as well.
Now, you've had hands-on experience in other countries like Bangladesh, Jordan and the Palestinian territories. Mm-hmm. So how does permaculture translate to these other climatic situations?
Well, as you can imagine, the Palestinian territories is quite different to Bangladesh. And when I teach in these countries, I basically set up a framework. I help them with the principles and they adapt the principles to their own climate, to their own conditions, to their own cultures. And it's very applicable in that it works with floods. So people in Bangladesh, it helps them work with the floods. And people in Jordan, for example, it helps work with droughts as well and how to keep water in the system and to have a much more lush system.
Well, these places that we're talking about, they're northern hemisphere, but they're quite warm. Does it work in cold climates as well? I mean, not necessarily northern hemisphere cold climates, Tasmania, say.
Yeah, well, Bill Mollison, the founder of permaculture, he's from Tasmania, and he basically started it in Tasmania, and it's been adapted from then, so very much so in Tasmania. He even had, I think, chickens near the house, so they warm the house up, and it's also about house design as well, so solar aspect, having your house facing, in this case, facing north and warming it up in winter. Once again, it comes back to smart design and using the weather conditions to your advantage.
Well, coming back into your own garden now, what mm-hmm. was that like when you first bought the land in Mullaney?
Well, for example, like many gardens, the vegetable garden was a long way away. And, you know, if you have a rainy day, you don't want to get those slippers wet, do you, going out to get a bit of parsley for the soup? So I basically started zoning it. So closest to the house, I had those things that I grow often, like herbs, and then going out a bit further, the veggie garden, going out further into zone 3, the fruit trees, further into zone 4, nut trees, and I even put in a cabinet timber plantation. I put that in quickly so I'd have a dowry ready in 25 years' time. And then further out in the final zone, zone 5, we've been regenerating rainforest.
This suggests quite a lot of initial intense planning. How did this work? Did you have to draw maps?
Yeah, I started off drawing a concept plan, and that basically looks at where things go, but not in detail. So I would think, okay, I'll put the orchard here, I'll put the nut trees here, some firewood trees here, but not yet go into species. And I did that on a big poster-sized piece of paper. And then I'd pull out pieces of this, and, for example, the orchard, I'd say, okay, well, the pecan tree likes it where it's very wet, I'll put it down there. I'll put the mulberry tree, which is a nice tree to pluck. I'll have that over the swinging chair so I can pluck away the mulberries while looking over the lagoon. And then going into a lot more detail, because in doing that, you need to know the maximum height and maximum width of the trees so you can work with them and place them in the best position to start with. And then if you do that, then it's a lot less work down the track.
It sounds as though you need to know quite a lot about local conditions, though. I mean, do you have to wait a bit before you start planning your permaculture garden? Just let a few seasons go past so you know what the conditions are?
That's a good point, Alan. I recommend, you know, even for a year to wait so you get an understanding of the seasons, where the sun shines at the different times of the year, where the frost goes. Go out on a cold night with, you know, just your bikinis on and feel those coldest spots in the garden. So you start to understand your land. And when you understand your land, you can work a lot better with it. A lot of people, I think, in their initial enthusiasm, rush in and plant up the garden. And once you've planted, for example, an olive tree that can last for 1,000 years, you certainly want to get it in the right place.
Now, so I'm there. I'm trying. I'm wearing my bikini, as you said, and I'm trying to.
I can see you there, yes, Alan. I can imagine it.
And I'm trying to create my permaculture garden. And one aspect of this is creating microclimates. That's an important mm-hmm. aspect of the success of the permaculture garden. So how have you achieved this, the microclimates, in your own garden?
Okay, for example, we get quite heavy frosts where we are, and I wanted to grow tropical trees that don't like frost and they like that high humidity. So we've got a lagoon that I put in, and frost always runs downhill like treacle. And so the house stops the frost coming down. So between the house and the dam, I've planted those tropical trees like an abu and a chocolate sapote, which is the chocolate pudding fruit, bananas. So basically the frost hits the house and goes around the house and misses those trees. And at the same time, the sun hits the lagoon, or in the morning hits the lagoon, and then comes up and shines off the lagoon onto the trees as well. So it's already starting from the moment that sun hits, that humidity is starting. And they love that humidity, and consequently I can grow trees there that I wouldn't be able to grow otherwise.
Now, these days many people get very impatient to see the results of their work in the garden. So how long do we have to wait? How long did your garden take to develop to a stage where you were able to sit back and enjoy it?
Well, it actually, I think, reflects the stages of my life I was going through. But I think you can get a fast start if you're not like me, like don't go ahead and plant your cabinet timbers to start with, because you might be waiting a fair while for those results. But if you start, for example, outside your door, so every time you're walking in, you can see those herbs growing, you can pluck them a lot. For example, when we walk into our house, we've got passion fruit, which the first year the passion fruit's fruiting and it drops balls of passion onto the veranda when we come home. We've got a cherry guava, which fruits after 2 years. That's cascades over the veranda. We've also got a grevillea honey gem just below where we eat breakfast. Each morning the lorikeets come in, and they've quite dramatic, those lorikeets, and more drama than your average soapy. So already we're creating a garden and our own little life in this small area in a short time. And then as we're there longer, we grow things that may take longer, such as the macadamia nuts and the pecan nuts. And so we can develop our garden over time, and it develops with us.
Well, you've mentioned herbs, you've mentioned macadamia nuts and pecan nuts. So obviously your garden produces quite a lot of food. What would be some of the more interesting types of food plants that you've got?
I like the miracle fruit. You eat the miracle fruit, it just looks like a red coffee bean, a simple little fruit, and then after it plays on the senses. And so after you eat it, everything you eat, even if it's a lemon or an olive, it will be sweet for the next half an hour. Mm-hmm. So it's especially good if you're not a very good cook. You can give this to people first and they love your food.
Well, yes.
But another fruit that I forgot to mention, oh, we've got the chocolate pudding fruit. And it just looked like a normal green globe, but you open it up and it's mushy black, like almost like mud. And we mix that with yogurt and vanilla and a bit of grated chocolate on top. And it actually does taste a bit like chocolate pudding.
So does this mean that you can eat most of your meals out of the garden, your own produce?
We can, but there's, I must admit, I do like a few extra things like those cheeses and a bit of chocolate to go on the chocolate pudding fruit, of course.
So are you ever faced with a glut of food from the garden?
Oh, yes, and that's another thing with designing a garden is that you want to design it so you don't have too many gluts, but the neighbours help out. I've got a guava and feijoa tree going along the road and my neighbour walks past every morning taking the dog for a walk and she likes to, you know, help herself, which is fine by me. But we've also got ways of dealing with gluts. We freeze quite a lot of food. We've got dryers as well. And some things like, for example, the Valencia orange, we would cut out the middle parts of it and dry the middle parts of the Valencia and dip them in chocolate, and they taste like Jaffas. And then the other half of the Valencia orange, we'd juice those ones, and then the cycle continues. So we'd put the Valencia skin on the fire, and then an aroma would come off the fire. It's just like an orange essence comes off the fire, and then they're dried out, and they can then be used as fire lighters for the fire because they've got a high oil content. And once again, when you use them as fire lighters, another aroma comes into the house, which is delicious. And then once that's all burnt down, we use the ashes on, for example, the bananas, which like high potassium, or asparagus. And so it's, the garden is continually cycling. So rather than a glut, I think the trick is to keep it moving, the cycles continuing and all interweaving as well.
Now, food production isn't the only thing that a paradise garden is about. What are the aesthetic considerations that you've taken into account?
Well, one thing I wanted to do with our garden, because we get quite a few visitors through, is to make it beautiful as well. Some permaculture gardens have a lot of mulch and sweet potato, for example, and they can be a bit scruffy. I wanted this to be a garden where people felt at home and felt relaxed and looked at it, and it is beautiful.
Well, yes, there's a photo in your book that shows a garden with veggies and flowers in a lush embrace. So is it important to mix different sorts of plants together in the one bed rather than to set out the more formal designs that you often see today with hedging and banks of only one plant?
Yeah, if you, for example, plant your vegetables in rows, it's for the pests, it's like going down a supermarket aisle and helping themselves. What we do is try and mix up the vegetables because the pests determine what they're going to eat by its aroma or its silhouette. So we mix up lots of different silhouettes together and also put in aromatic plants, even mixing up the spring onions, which are quite aromatic, mixing them up with the lettuces, for example. And also the flowers, you might notice in the photos, there's cosmos, for example. Cosmos attracts predatory insects, which actually attack pests. And so we have a lot of flowers like this that attract the predators, so that, once again, I talked about designing with nature. It's about working with nature so nature does the work. Instead of us being out there trying to swat the pests, nature's doing it for us.
Well, Jenny's book is called Paradise in Your Garden, and it's published by New Holland. Jenny Allen, unfortunately, it's time to put away our tools, so thank you very much indeed for joining me on The Comfort Zone.
Thank you, Alan.
And that's it for The Comfort Zone this week. My thanks to the team, producers Kerry Stewart and Mark Wakeley. Technical production for Saturday mornings on Radio National is by John Diamond. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with another Comfort Zone.